called me the howling wolf mama. And you found me howling at your door.
I would sit there by myself listening to this guy, I had no idea who he was, somewhere in Chicago, howling at the moon and shaking a fist at something. And subsequently in 1975, all we did was reinvent this guy's music but play it at three times the speed.
That was Bob Geldof, just one of the many young British musicians who were simply blown away when they heard Howling Wolf in the early 1960s. I'm Bruce Dickinson, and the next half an hour is dedicated to one of the greatest and most influential of all blues singers, who died 30 years ago. Last week we heard how Wolf became the king of Chicago blues and a hugely successful recording artist. This week we'll hear how Wolf's reputation for being scary was well justified, and how he became known to a totally new audience as the hero of the British bands that invaded America. Jeff Beck.
You know, although we may not have been as poor or as downtrodden, but we feel it when you're 17 and 18 or whatever. Being told that everything you do is wrong, you feel the whole world's against you, and that music resonates in a way that no other music did. And to have Wolf shout it that loud was just like somebody speaking for you, you know.
A lot of people's wondering, what is the blues? I hear a lot of people saying the blues, but I'm gonna tell you what the blues is. When you ain't got no money, you got the blues. When you ain't got no money to pay your house rent, you still got the blues. A lot of people holler about, I don't like no blues, but when you ain't got no money and can't pay your house rent and can't buy you no food, you damn sure got the blues. I'm gonna show you how to play the blues. Now you just sit here and watch me. You know when you got a lazy woman, then you have to come in and tell her, say, baby, why don't you sweep up the house? And she'll jump up and tell you, sweep it up yourself. I'm gonna get up in the morning, I believe I dust my broom. I'm gonna get up in the morning, I believe I dust my broom.
That was taken from the DVD The Howling Wolf Story. Although young musicians were loving the music they heard, they still couldn't get to hear it live. Instead, they began studying Wolf's records and performing his songs themselves. The first time the general public in Britain heard a Howling Wolf song was when the Rolling Stones released their version of Wolf's Little Red Rooster.
We took a huge risk. That was our fourth single. No, fifth. When we went in the studio to cut that, Andrew Oldham said, oh, for God's sake, you can't do that. Yeah, we want to put it out as a single. You're crazy. You ruined your career. The record company hated it. He hated it. Everybody hated it. And we put it out as a single on the Friday night, and on Monday morning it was number one in the NME. I swear to you. And it's the only real blues single that's ever been released in England and gone to number one. And it did it in 2 days.
I am the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day. I am the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day.
And unlike some artists who'd plagiarised those who'd gone before, the Rolling Stones were quick to acknowledge Wolf.
We didn't just take their songs, like Lonnie Donegan did, and say he wrote them, trad arranged, all the Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly things. We actually said this is a Howling Wolf song, this is a Muddy Waters song, this is Slim Harpo, this is Elmore James. You know. So the kids got to know this, and then they went out searching for the records.
But listening to records and watching skinny English boys trying to perform the blues was no substitute for the real thing. Jeff Beck.
It was very difficult to come away from your house, not, you know, knowing whether you were going to ever see that for real. So when I heard that Wolf was on in Croydon, I shot up there like an Exocet missile, and never forget the concert. ¶¶
Wolf had come to Croydon as part of his first European tour in 1964. It was a huge deal.
Wolf was playing to the crowd a little bit, saying that he flew over on a giant silver bird. I'm not joking. He used to make out that we Negroes don't know what jet travel is. It was a great thing, you know. But he sang about 4 feet off the mic, and Hubert was in there. They all had their best clothes on, very shiny suits, and dressed up for the occasion.
And the tour was some occasion. It was part of the much bigger American Folk Blues Festival, which showcased blues talent across Europe. Wolf had no idea he had an audience outside America, and his guitarist, Hubert Sumlin, couldn't get over the reaction they received.
Those people treated us like we was the Beatles or the Rolling Stones when they came to the United States. That's the way we was over there. We didn't make the money because we made what we made. Everywhere we went, they were sold out.
But they weren't just treated like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. They were admired by them, too.
Two of the Beatles, two of the Rolling Stones. They came in, and they, both seats on this side, on the right and the left, with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. And then walked Jimi Hendrix. That's the first time I ever saw Jimi Hendrix, man. And we was on the bandstand playing. We froze with his guitar in his hand, man, when he saw Jimi Hendrix. And Jimi Hendrix came up and taken Wolf's guitar out of his hand with the playing with his teeth. He was there on the kind of we had made, I Should Have Quit You a Long Time Ago. And Jimi Hendrix had recorded the number. Yeah. And they gave us a standing ovation, man. I never forget it.
I should have quit you long time ago. Oh, I should have quit you, baby.
And the superstars of British rock and roll were just as thrilled to come face to face with Wolf.
He was very imposing, you know, he really was.
Yeah, really frightening, very. You felt very unsure about approaching him, you know, and because you didn't know whether he had a violent temper or whether he'd just knock you out the window or whatever. But when you got to talk to him, he was a sweetheart. Big, huge jaw, all unshaved a bit, and massive feet. He was like a mountain. But then, when you get to know him, he's just a sweet guy. Very mild and all that, you know, and I liked him a lot.
As Bill Wyman said, Wolf could be a sweetheart, but he still cut an imposing figure, and more so offstage than on. British guitarist Dave Kelly backed Wolf in 64 and experienced firsthand the reality of being on tour with a musician from a very different world.
Chris, our roadie, his parents lived in Lincoln and they were away on holiday, so he said, we'll all go over there. Yeah, Wolf got the master bedroom and he said, I didn't know you had a house like this, I thought you was a hippie. And then the next Sunday lunchtime, the next day, Chris said, we go down the ferry boat for lunch, and there's a very middle-class pub. And, Wolf was a bit edgy, being very big, very black, in a very white middle-class pub at Sunday lunchtime, you know, kind of people looking at him, you know. And Chris said to the landlord, this is the great Howling Wolf, he's a really famous blues singer, and, you know... And the landlord came over and said, shook his head, hello, Mr. Wolf. Oh, they're looking after you all right.
The tour was a huge success, and although Wolf found the environment offstage strange and unfamiliar, he was always at home when he was on stage. David Kelly remembers how Wolf gave it his all every night and captivated the British audiences.
I know he'd been on the phone to his wife that afternoon quite a long time, and he was a bit homesick. And he went out among the audience, down on one knee, and sang, "Did I hurt your feelings? You know I didn't mean do you no wrong." So it was just a very quiet blues with very little happening other than the straight backing, you know, and him giving this performance that was just awe-inspiring. I'm getting tingles down my spine just remembering it, you know. He was absolute master. That was the blues, that really was. He was, you know, in every word.
Boy, and you know I was raised out on the farm. Woman, if you love me, you would teach me right from wrong.
One of the most remarkable things about Wolf was his ability to convey an enormous range of emotions with unparalleled conviction. True, he had a gentle side, but it's also true he had a dangerous side. Hubert Sumlin.
He chopped a man's head off, man.
Yes, sir.
Biographer Mark Hoffman explains what happened back in Wolf's plantation days.
He'd gotten involved with some woman who dragged him home from a little juke joint in Mississippi. He went home with his woman and didn't realize that she had another boyfriend, or maybe he did realize it and it didn't matter. He found out that this woman's boyfriend had beaten her up. Wolf and this guy exchanged words, probably threatened Wolf, maybe pulled out a knife on him, and Wolf hit the guy over the head with a cotton hoe and took the top of his head clean off, killed him instantly.
Though several people are aware of this story, there are no records of Wolf having been convicted of that crime. Mark Hoffman believes that wouldn't have been unusual.
Basically, the authorities didn't care. On the plantation where Wolf worked, black people would kill each other on the weekends and then just go onto the field next Monday morning as if nothing happened. The saying was, if you kept yourself out of the graveyard, the boss man on the plantation would keep you out of jail.
So Wolf avoided jail, but many believe one of his biggest songs, Killing Floor, was a direct reference to that incident.
I should have quit you a long time ago. I should have quit you, babe, long time ago. I should have quit you and went on to Mexico. If I had a father, my first mine. If I had a father, my first mine, I'd have been gone. It's my second
Jeff Beck was drawn to the dangerous side of Wolf's music and remembers playing that song with him in a scary club back in Chicago. Jeff was on tour at the time and had to persuade his entourage to go with him.
No one else wanted to come with me because they thought they were going to get shot or a bottle over their head. And I don't care if I get shot or the bottle, as long as I get to see Alan Wolf.
I said, where the f*** you think all our music comes from?
You know, but there we were, right slap in the middle of the south side of Chicago, Teresa's. Unbelievable. It's just he had the bass drum with Killing Floor Band written on it. someone must have said to Wolf that there's a skinny white dude from England, maybe you let him sit in. He just, these words, I started quaking, you know. We played Going Down Slow and Killing Floor, you know. I was shaking, you know. To hear that voice blasting in my ear, I flew home. I walked, but I was flying.
And Jeff wasn't the only white British boy in America wanting to sit in with Wolf. It was the height of the British invasion. The Rolling Stones and the Beatles had absorbed the blues into their own brand of chart-topping rock and roll and was selling it back to a rapturous American audience. When they were asked to make their American TV debut on the rock show Shindig, the Rolling Stones took the opportunity to acknowledge their hero.
We said, we'll do it if you have Howlin' Wolf on with us. And a lot of them didn't know who we were talking about, actually. We said, if we don't have Wolf, we're not going to do it. Because on the show was Sonny and Cher, and there was all these kind of people, and there were a few other sort of poppy bands on that. And to have Howlin' Wolf come in, it was a bit of a sort of mind-blower, you know. And all I kept hearing, which had us in fits of laughter all the time, was, OK, Mr. Howling, we're ready for you now. And we would fold up, you know, this huge black guy sort of would appear to, what do you want me to do, you know. But he was wonderful.
How many more yells have I got to let your dog be around? How many more yells have I got to let your dog be around?
Among that huge, white TV audience hungry for British stars was Bonnie Raitt.
It really was Howlin' Wolf on Shindig, which who they only shot from the waist down. That's when I first got a taste of him, then I went and got his records, and that was it. There's a love affair that hasn't abated since.
And Chess Records spotted an opportunity to make the most of this blossoming love affair. Here's Marshall Chess.
There was a period where black people in general stopped buying blues as much as they did. We were trying anything we could to market them to a wider audience. And when we saw the white album audience growing, we did try to creatively shift our artists into that market. We were in the record business, and so were our recording artists. They didn't really want to be international folk heroes. They wanted to make money.
And to capitalize on this growing market, Marshall Chess took Wolf in a different direction. They recorded an electric concept album.
Basically, it was driven by the success of Electric Mud and hoping to expand him into new markets, which I think it did to some extent. Unlike Muddy, who got a kick out of doing the Electric Mud, Wolf never seemed to like it. He just didn't get it, didn't put the magic into it that he could. He was just not that physically well, his energy was low, and he didn't really like it.
The album was not well received. But the Chess brothers were undeterred and came up with another idea, this time to record Wolf with the coolest British rock stars in the hippest city in the world. In 1970, Wolf returned to England with guitarist Hubert to record the London Howling Wolf sessions. Bill Wyman remembers getting the call.
I was up in my country house in Suffolk on a weekend, and Glyn Johns, the engineer, rang me up. And he said, do you want to do a session? Monday, Tuesday. So I said, what is it? You know, because I've got a weekend off, I'm having a break, you know. And he says, well, we're recording Howlin' Wolf in London. Eric's doing it, and Ian Stewart, our piano player. I said, of course, you know. And I jumped in my car and came down to London. And he said, we started the day before, you know, but we used Ringo and Klaus Voormann on the rhythm section. It didn't work. I said, well, of course it wouldn't work in that case. Ringo and Klaus Voormann, have they ever heard of a Howlin' Wolf? They probably still haven't heard of a Howlin' Wolf record.
But despite Bill Wyman's intimate knowledge of Wolf's material, the session didn't go as smoothly as expected. When the band sat down to record Little Red Rooster, it became obvious they needed a little help from Wolf himself.
I don't think Eric had ever played Little Red Rooster before. You know, he'd heard us, obviously. He might have messed with it at home, but I don't think he'd ever done it on stage. And it's a weird timing.
You and Hubert, take it.
All right.
Now you
okay.
Play it that way.
You sure you wouldn't like... Why don't you play acoustic on it? No. With us, man. If you play, see, if you played with us, well, then we'd be able to follow you better.
Okay, let's try it. I doubt if I can do it without you.
Oh, man, come on. He ain't got nothing to do with counting up and change on the... And you know what you said? One. In when you said, you said, boom.
When that rehearsal was released on the album, many assumed that Wolf was irritated by the stumbles and false starts, which reinforced the idea that white boys couldn't play the blues. Hubert, however, remembers it differently.
Eric started this man who had come out so beautiful. And my Mick Jagger, he came in. Oh man, we had a fun doing this session.
Well, I ain't superstitious, but a black cat I've crossed my trade.
The sessions were a great success, but they were hampered by Wolf's ill health. He was playing with young men, but Wolf was 70 at the time and had suffered several heart attacks. Still, he showed no signs of slowing down and carried on recording and performing live. His last releases, Live and Cooking at Alice's and Backdoor Wolf, were hailed as some of his finest work. In 1975, Wolf's reputation was cemented with a Grammy nomination, but it was the appreciation of the rock and roll audiences that meant most to him. The same year, the Rolling Stones played Chicago as part of their US tour. Bill Wyman.
Someone told me that Wolf had been hoping to come and see us, but he didn't have money, he didn't have tickets, and it had gone into the press, and about 1,000 people had offered their tickets to him, because he was known in the town. But he was so proud he wouldn't take them, and he was hoping that one of us would call him up, so I arranged a car. And I said, we're on in 10 minutes, you know, you better get out there. And as he went into the crowd, the whole crowd stood up, bit by bit, until they were all standing up, all cheering and applauding him. And his wife, Lily, after, said it was one of the greatest moments of his life. 40,000 people standing applauding him, you know.
The next night, it was Wolf's turn to entertain Bill.
They came backstage again and invited us all to dinner at their house. And had a wonderful evening with him. Right until the early hours. It was great. We just sat around, just talking about music and all that, and I said, put one of your records on. And I wanted to hear him, like, when he was there, and hear him growl through them, but he said, I haven't got any. I said, what do you mean you haven't got any? Because you could call Chess Records up and get them, you know, but he was probably too proud again. He said, well, people come by and they say, oh, can I have that record? And I've just let them take my records. I felt so sort of sad for him. And because he wasn't that well then.
By the mid-70s, 1974, 1975, he could only perform a few songs in every set, and most of the time he'd have to perform sitting down. But at times he would still have these bursts of energy, and he just wouldn't give up. He was such an inspiration for so many young musicians who saw him a relatively old man in his early 60s who was obviously not going to be around much longer, who would not quit. He was going to go out singing.
I have had my fun. If I never get well no more, get well no more. Oh, my health is failing on me. Oh, yes, I'm going down slow.
Wolf was due to fly to Paris on tour when he was rushed into hospital. He sent for his right-hand man, Hubert, who was not just his invaluable guitarist, but the man he affectionately referred to as his son.
After I got to the hospital, man, Wolf was sitting up there eating corn sandwiches chicken. He said, Hubert, your father is sick, man. I see I can't go. See, this is what I want you to do. Go ahead on and hold our name. Keep our name going. Please, don't let me down. I said, you know I ain't going to let you down, man. I got over there. I went on and left him in the hospital. I worked 4 days. And I got this telegram. If you want to see Wolf, your daddy, you better make it. He got something to tell you. They got me on the next plane. And I went straight to the hospital. And there, Wolf, eyes were taped up. He was dead already. But I said, that man is dead, you know. Wolf is dead. And sure enough, man, that hurt me. No, that hurt me, sir.
Please write my mama. I'm in. Please write my mother. Tell her to shape I'm in.
When he died, I was on tour in Europe, actually, with the Stones when he died. I got a letter from his wife, Lily, asking me if I had any film footage, video. She said, we just want something to remember him by, because we've got nothing to show his career to our grandchildren or anything. So bloody sad it was, and I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't help her, really. I didn't have anything. I really felt bad about it, after leaving a great legacy like he did.
You know, I did tours with Hooker, and I loved, you know, Johnny's a nice guy, and I loved playing with him, but it wasn't the buzz of playing with Wolf, because Wolf was just the man.
If you want to, like, use a parallel of classical music, instead of Beethoven, Mozart, and Bach, you had, you know, Muddy Waters, Sonny Boy Williamson, and Howling Wolf. He was one of our key original great artists, along with Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Etta James, a true original great.
In a fitting tribute to a truly great artist, Howling Wolf was inducted into both the Blues Foundation Hall of Fame and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. 30 years after his death, Wolf's music continues both to terrify and inspire. I was Bruce Dickinson. The Howling Wolf story was a Smooth Operations production, and I'll leave the last word to Bob Geldof.
Still, I listen to the original versions, and of all the guys that I always listen to, Howling Wolf is unbelievably brilliant, and Smokestack Lightning is one of the great rock songs.